coming to his feet and swinging his rifle at the guard, whose body armor had protected him from Crispin's return fire. The butt of Crispin's sniper rifle found the guard's head, knocking him to one side. In one smooth motion, Crispin let go of his sniper rifle and pulled the sidearm from under his jacket, firing multiple times. His shots walked across the tumbling guard's chest and would have caused no injury at all had the guard not lost his balance and fallen into the path of the energy blast. The last two blasts caught the guard in the face, killing him instantly. Crispin tossed the gun aside and picked up his tray, wasting no time departing the area. He had no idea why the guard had come to their room. No shots had been fired, and he had heard no unanswered calls for High Boy 4 over the comms box. Once inside the elevator, Crispin quickly placed the comms jammer back into its hiding place under the tray face, then left the tray on the floor of the elevator. The plainclothes guard at the first floor elevator doors turned to face the doors as they opened and was met with a man's fist. He then disappeared, pulled into the elevator itself by his attacker, after which the doors closed. A minute later, the doors opened and Crispin stepped out, moving quickly back to the catering area where he knew he would be expected to report during a crisis. All he had to do was keep his cool and play his part. There would be interrogations. He and everyone who had worked or attended the party would likely be detained well into the night. But there was no evidence that Crispin or Martin Reynolds, which was the name on his ID badge, had any involvement in the tragic event. He had not seen any cameras inside the house nor the third floor hallway, and he had worn gloves the entire time. Luckily, although a little wrinkled and dirty, his white server's jacket showed no signs of his scuffle with the elevator guard. Miraculously, Crispin actually had a chance of escaping. Admiral Gagliardi was whisked away by a squad of Marines who plowed their way through the panicked crowd, breaking through to the east toward the temporary airfield where the Admiral's shuttle was already spun up and ready for liftoff. Within 3 minutes of detonation, the Admiral was being shoved into his shuttle. "Reports are coming in from all over Alliance space," the duty officer told the Admiral as the shuttle began to lift off. "Kohara, Sorensen, Kent, Corpora, Pileus, Weldon... There have been assassination attempts on nearly every industrialized world within the Sol Alliance." "How many are dead?" Admiral Gagliardi asked as the shuttle jumped to orbit. "Nothing is confirmed yet, but so far reports indicate 12 of 20 Alliance world leaders have been assassinated. Sir, we're also getting intel that indicates this may be a coordinated attack by Jung deep cover operatives, possibly sleeper agents. General, I strongly recommend put all forces on maximum alert," Admiral Gagliardi ordered. "Already done, sir." "What about President Scott?" the Admiral asked, already knowing the answer. "I'm afraid everyone on the stage was killed, sir," the officer replied. "Nothing is confirmed. It's chaos down there." "Sir," the pilot called back, "we're getting reports that 4 persons from the stage are being airlifted to the hospital."
"Are any of them the President?" the Admiral asked.
"Unknown, sir."
"We'll fucking find out," the Admiral barked.
"Colonel," he said, speaking directly to the duty officer again.
"I'm declaring global martial law."
"Sir?"
"You heard me."
"Yes, sir."
"And send word to all Alliance worlds. I'm taking control of Earth until further notice."
"Admiral, there is a chain of succession. There were at least a dozen members of that chain of succession on the stage when it blew the fuck up, Colonel," the Admiral yelled. "For all we know, someone further down that chain of succession is in collusion with the Jung. Did you ever think of that, Colonel?"
"No, sir. I mean, yes, sir."
"Make it happen, Colonel," the Admiral concluded.
"Yes, sir."
"I did everything short of threatening his life, Captain," Ido Yokama explained to Nathan over the vidcom link displayed on the view screen on the wall of the Captain's ready room. "He is determined to prevent Rakuen from joining the Karuzari Alliance. He is a staunch traditionalist, blind to the demands of changing times."
"How much influence does he have over the population?" Nathan wondered.
"Enough to hold the line for some time, I'm afraid. I must say, though, that your recent defense of Rakuen will likely convince some of his constituents that Rakuen should join. It might have had even more impact if you had dispatched the second frigate yourself instead of allowing the Gunyoki to do so."
"The Gunyoki needed to taste victory, even a small one."
"I understand," Ito said. "I'm afraid that it may take longer than anticipated to change Minister Seberon's mind."
"Is there any way to force the issue to be voted on by the people of Rakuen?" Nathan asked.
"That would be extremely unlikely," Ito explained. "Rakuens only vote once every 10 years to elect our government officials.
We trust those officials to make such decisions on our behalf. Calling for a people's vote on such a thing would require the support of an overwhelming majority of the Rakuan Congress. That's at least 87 votes, and that's just to initiate a popular vote on the matter.
You make it sound difficult.
That's because it is, Ito assured him. I've only seen it happen once before, and that was when I pushed to turn the Ganyoki training flights into a competition for profit.
Then you at least know how it's done, Nathan realized.
I do, but it is not something I care to repeat.
I don't think you have much choice, Mr. Yokima, Nathan reminded him.
Ito sighed, obviously displeased by the hold Nathan now had on him. I will attempt to get the process started, Captain, but I warn you, it will take time.
Are we talking months or years?
As this is a matter of importance, I would guess months.
How long did it take you to get the vote on turning the Ganyoki into a competition? Nathan wondered.
3.5 years, I'm afraid.
Let's hope it doesn't take that long, Nathan replied.
Good luck, Mr. Yokima.
Nathan pressed the button to deactivate the VidCon link. He looked at Jessica sitting on the couch under the viewscreen.
You know, it would help if you didn't make faces at me while I'm on a call.
A girl's gotta have some fun, Jessica defended.
Did you get the damage reports on the Ronnie plant?
Yep, she replied, sitting upright again. The power plant is toast. They're running on portable reactors on loan from one of Yokima's plants. But it's going to slow them down somewhat. The bastards knew where to hit them, which means they had good intel.
I don't like the sound of that.
Me either. Fortunately, they had just shipped a load of emitters and jump field generators to the race platform only 2 hours before the Dusan attacked.
Then their intel isn't inside the Ronnie plant, Nathan surmised.
That would be my guess, yes.
How many units?
Enough to outfit another 20 Ganyoki fighters, Jessica replied.
That'll make 20 Ganyoki pilots happy, Nathan commented. They were a bit frustrated after trying to fight those Octo fighters. Those damn things jump about every 10 seconds. What about the race platform?
The hangar bay is out of service, and the observation deck is open to space, but other than that, not much. I'm pretty sure it wasn't their primary target. I think they were just trying to split our defenses.
And it almost worked, Nathan agreed.
Almost doesn't count.
Jessica changed her position, leaning forward, her forearms resting on her knees as she looked down at the deck. Nathan recognized her body language.
What is it?
We've got some SIGINT less than an hour ago, she explained, for one of our stealth recon drones. It's about the Koronari.
The Koronari? I thought they had disbanded years ago.
Okay, the ex-Koronari, Jessica admitted. They've been rounded up by the Dusan. Apparently, they had all gone into hiding after the Dusan began capturing every Koronarin who had ever served in any military organization. Koronarin, Takarin, even in the Alliance. Some of them had even formed a loose resistance of sorts. The Dusan have rounded them all up, or at least most of them. The only intel we have to go on are the news reports, and for all we know, they're all propaganda.
What are they going to do with them?
The Dusan assimilate manpower into their forces, Jessica told him. They're going to give them a choice, serve the Dusan, or spend the rest of their lives at hard and likely dangerous labor.
Slave soldiers or slave laborers, Nathan sighed.
Nice choice.
You know damn well not a single Koronari will choose to serve the Dusan, Jessica said.
I know.
We have to find a way to rescue them, Nathan.
I know.
So how are we going to do it?
You're the tactical officer and a Gadajok, Nathan reminded her. Don't you have any ideas?
Yep, but you're not going to like it, Jessica warned.
Try me, Nathan insisted.
Jessica rose from the couch. After I run it past Talus, she insisted. I suspect he'll suggest a few changes.
After being interrogated several times and being held for hours at the Scott estate, Crispin and the rest of the catering staff were released but warned to remain in the area for the next few days. Crispin was surprised that no one had asked him about his time on the third floor, especially considering that two guards had been killed and the guards who Crispin had delivered food to had been found unconscious. The only thing Crispin could figure was that someone, most likely the operative who had given him the assignment to deliver the food, had somehow removed Crispin's alias from the movement logs. One thing Crispin was sure of, eventually they would figure things out. And when they did, they would come for him. He had no intention of waiting for them to do so. Once Crispin arrived at his hotel room, he immediately changed clothes and IDs, and then left, taking a bus to the train station and the train to the next city over. Once there, he took several buses to the far side of that town before renting a vehicle to drive to yet another city. 12 hours, 4 different IDs, and more than a dozen checkpoints later, Crispin had made it all the way to Seattle. His only hope was to make it onto a flight to a remote part of the world, someplace where the local government was still stable enough to resist Admiral Gagliardi's imposition of global martial law.
"You will stand!"
the guard yelled to the occupants of the cell where Jonas Pritchett was being held. Jonas and the 5 other prisoners stood as instructed. Michael watched from his cell, knowing they would be next. One of the guards opened the cell door and 2 more guards stepped inside, followed by a Dusan officer.
"The choice is simple," the officer said, obviously not wanting to waste any more time than necessary on a task he felt beneath him. "Serve the Dusan and you will live meaningful and productive lives. Refuse and you will spend the remainder of your days at hard labor in deplorable conditions."
The prisoners stood at attention, as best their tired, beaten bodies would allow, staring straight ahead. The Dusan officer walked the length of the line of men, stopping at the end, opposite from Jonas. He looked at the last man in line.
"What say you?"
"I speak for these men,"
Jonas stated confidently from the other end of the line. The Dusan officer turned back toward Jonas, tilting his head in curiosity. After stepping back, he scanned the line of men.
"Is this true?"
"Coronari!"
Jonas barked sharply.
"Hup, hup, hup!"
The line of men replied proudly and in unison.
"As you wish,"
the officer agreed. He turned and walked over to Jonas, taking a moment to study his face.
"So, Mr. Pritchett, how say you?"
"That's Major Pritchett,"
Jonas corrected. The officer smiled, amused by the man's pride.
"Do not test me, Major," the officer warned. "I will ask one more time," he said, his voice seething. "How say you?"
"The coronari serve the people of Coroner and no other."
Jonas shifted his gaze to look directly into the Dusan officer's eyes.
"On behalf of myself and my men, we respectfully decline your offer to serve the Dusan Empire."
"Too bad," the officer replied calmly. "You would have made fine additions. Men like you are hard to come by."
The officer walked to the cell door, then turned back around to address the 6 prisoners one last time.
"Ironically, you will serve the Empire regardless of your decision. I do, however, respect your decision to stand by your principles. You would be surprised how few we have conquered who have been willing to do the same."
The Dusan officer turned and walked out of the cell, barking orders in his native language as he headed for the next one. The guards immediately herded Jonas and his men out of the cell and down the corridor, presumably to meet their fate as slave laborers.
"Remember what I said," Michael whispered to Burke and Cuddy as the guards came to their cell door.
"On your feet,"
the guard ordered as he unlocked their cell door. Michael, Burke, Cuddy, and the other 3 prisoners in the cell rose to their feet, forming a line just as Jonas and his men had done. Michael moved casually away from Burke and Cuddy, taking his place at the end of the line. They too stood at attention as best their weary bodies would allow. 2 guards entered the cell, taking up positions at the front corners, their weapons ready. The Dusan officer followed a moment later, entering the cell and coming to stand a meter before the door.
"The choice is simple," the officer said as before. "Serve the Dusan and you will live meaningful and productive lives. Refuse and you will spend the remainder of your miserable existence at hard labor in conditions unbefitting a snarda beast."
The officer walked the line just as before, inspecting the group of men assembled before him, coming to a stop at the end of the line in front of Michael.
"Michael Willard," the officer said, disdain in his voice. "This offer does not extend to you. This offer is for men, not mutineers."
"It matters not," Michael replied proudly. "I may not be coronari, but I too refuse to serve your pathetic little empire."
"You are not worthy of the coronari," the officer said, stepping to the left in front of the next man.
Without even looking at Michael, in one smooth motion, the officer pulled his sidearm, placed it against Michael's right cheek, and fired. Cuddy gasped and Burke turned away as Michael fell to the ground, gasping for breath through the gaping hole in his face.
"How say you?"
the officer asked the next man in line. I respectfully decline to serve the Dusan Empire, the man stated proudly. The officer said nothing to the second man, moving to the next. Cuddy tried not to look at Michael's lifeless body as blood pooled around his face and neck. By now, Michael's breathing was almost non-existent, and his gaze had become completely vacant, staring at someplace only he could see. Burke had his eyes closed, afraid to open them, as the officer moved down the line, accepting the polite refusals from each man. The officer finally reached Cuddy, noticing the effect Michael's now dead body was having on the young man.
He was a friend of yours?
Sort of, Cuddy admitted.
Not really, I guess.
You are not Koronari, the officer surmised. Cuddy's expression suddenly changed, becoming full of rage.
No, I'm not, he replied, his anger growing. But I too, no,
Burke yelled, interrupting his friend. Don't do it, Cuddy. Burke looked at the officer.
It's all my fault. The guns fell into our yard. It was my idea to sell them. I just wanted some extra money. We aren't Koronari. We're just a couple of college students. We were scared, and we agreed to join the resistance because we were afraid they were going to kill us. I'll serve the Dusan.
Burke, no, Cuddy argued.
Shut up, Cuddy, Burke insisted. And so will he. We don't want to die. We'll serve you. I swear it.
The officer studied Burke for a moment, then Cuddy. Neither of you will make good soldiers, he decided. However, there are many roles in which you can serve. The officer smiled. Cook's assistant, laundry, housekeeping. He looked at Cuddy.
How say you?
Please,
Burke whispered to his friend. Cuddy looked at Burke, then back at the Dusan officer before him.
I will serve the Empire,
he finally said begrudgingly. The officer smiled and then turned to look at Burke.
Your friend is a far braver man than you, I'm afraid.
The officer stepped over in front of Burke.
I'm pretty sure I already know your answer. However, protocol requires that I ask. So, how say you?
I choose to serve the Empire,
Burke sobbed, embarrassed by his own weakness. The guard turned sharply around, barking more orders in his native tongue as he walked out of the cell, turning to go to the next. The guards herded the three men who had refused service toward the exit. The last man looked at Burke and Cuddy as he left, nodding respectfully as he departed. A moment later, two more guards stepped in to herd Burke and Cuddy out as well, taking them down a different corridor than the others, presumably to their new lives as members of the Dusan Empire. Neither of them looked back at Michael's dead body. They couldn't. We are now getting reports from multiple sources, all of which are confirming that the assassination attempts on leaders of Alliance worlds are believed to be a coordinated attempt by the Zhang Empire to destabilize the Alliance and its military forces, possibly as the first step in a coordinated attack on not only the Earth, but all of the Sol Pentaurus Alliance. NAU investigators have confirmed that President Scott and his family were killed by an explosive device that was set by a Zhang sleeper agent by the name of Sarah Jassa, who died in the blast. Authorities are still searching for Miss Jassa's accomplice, Crispin Bornett, who somehow managed to get hired on at the last moment as a server for the event at the late president's estate. Mr. Bornett is an ex-Marine with special operations training and is considered armed and dangerous. Anyone spotting Mr. Bornett is strongly advised to stay clear of him and report his location to authorities as quickly as possible. Crispin stood in the Sydney airport, staring at the view screen in disbelief, his heart sinking at the news of the death of his beloved Sarah. Now it was all beginning to make sense. Both of them had been played by Gagliardi, if in fact that was who had hired him in the first place. But it had to be Gagliardi, Crispin thought. He had the most to gain from the death of President Scott, and he would be the only one with the power and reach to coordinate similar assassinations on other Alliance worlds. Crispin's mind was reeling. He looked around, suddenly feeling as if every person in the terminal was staring at him. He felt his pulse racing, his breath quickening. He had to control himself. He had to think. He quickly headed to the exit, making his way to the public transit station outside. Within minutes, he was on a train headed for the city. Crispin moved to the back of the train car, taking a seat and pulling his cap down over his face, pretending to be taking a nap. He quickly took inventory of his situation. The picture of him on the news was recent, but not too recent. He had 2 days' growth on his face and had already changed his hair color from blonde to black. It was a start, but it would not be enough. If he could lay low somewhere for a week or two, his facial hair would thicken, offering him additional concealment. Still, it would not be enough. If he remained on Earth, he would eventually be apprehended. If Admiral Gagliardi was making a play for the control of the Earth and the entire Alliance, he could not afford any loose ends. Crispin would not be arrested. He would be killed. Of that he was certain. Unfortunately, Crispin had very little money on him, definitely not enough to keep him fed and clothed for more than a few days. He needed help, help from someone he could trust. But very few people met that criteria. In fact, he could think of only one person who even came close, and he had not spoken to her in several years. Admiral Gagliardi entered the Alliance Fleet Command press room, moving quickly to the podium at the front of the room. There were no pleasantries, no greetings, no friendly exchanges with familiar reporters, waiting to hear what the Admiral had to say. Michael Gagliardi was there on business, deadly serious business. "There will be no questions," the Admiral began. "I am here to make a statement only." The Admiral took a pause, reviewing his notes on the data pad before him. 2 days ago, sleeper agents of the Zhang Empire executed a carefully planned, well-coordinated attack directly against the leaders of the 12 most powerful worlds within the Sol Alliance. I am saddened to report that 10 of those assassinations were successful, including that of our own president, Dayton Scott. The intricacies of this plan would require years, if not decades, of preparation. The logistics of interstellar communication alone tells us that these plans have been in motion since at least as far back as the ceasefire agreement between the Zhang Empire and the Sol Alliance. Such actions constitute a violation of the ceasefire agreement, meaning that a state of war now exists between us. As you are all aware, since returning to command, I have insisted the Zhang could not be trusted, and that someday we would have to face them again. I take no satisfaction in being right in this instance. However, I do take comfort in the knowledge that this time, we are prepared to defeat our enemy with relatively few losses in Alliance lives. Unfortunately, a declaration of war requires a vote of the Alliance Council, which is now impossible due to the attack by the Zhang Empire. This was undoubtedly their goal all along, to cripple our government, to create panic and chaos among our peoples, to sow discord within our political parties and institutions. Also, we would fail to take action when action is the only thing that can save us. The Admiral took a breath, glancing down at his notes again before continuing. He paused as if he suddenly did not want to say what was on his data pad. He looked at the faces of the press, every pair of eyes locked on him, hanging on his every word. He leaned on one arm just enough to appear a bit informal, then took a deep breath and continued. When I took my oath of service, both times, I swore to do everything within my power to protect and serve the people of Earth and of all those worlds aligned with her. It is an oath that I and every man and woman under my command take seriously. Being a leader sometimes means you have to make terrible decisions. It sometimes means you have to break the very rules you have sworn to uphold in order to protect those entrusted to you. All too often it means having to send brave men and women to their deaths and in too great of numbers. The worst thing a leader can do is fail to act. Therefore, I am taking action, and I am doing what I, as commander of all Alliance forces, believe is necessary to protect all the people of the Alliance. Admiral Gagliardi squared up to the cameras at the back of the room, again taking a more official posture. In the wake of the assassinations of 10 world leaders and the imminent threat of attack by the Zhang Empire, I am declaring interstellar martial law throughout all Alliance space. Furthermore, I am assuming control of all Alliance worlds that have suffered a loss of leadership until such time as those worlds can conduct lawful elections to replace them. In addition, at this very moment, a first strike against every Zhang battle platform whose location is currently known to us is being carried out. I intend to continue these strikes until such time as the Zhang Empire's ability to wage war against the Sol Alliance, or any other world, is no more. As of this moment, the Sol Alliance is at war with the Zhang Empire. It is a war that we shall win, and we shall do so most decidedly. That is all. Admiral Gagliardi kept his promise and left the podium without answering any of the questions being shouted at him as he departed the press room. Jesus, that took balls. Commander McLay said as he walked alongside the Admiral down the corridors of Fleet Command.
It was just a speech, Commander. You just took control of 28 worlds, sir. 10, actually, the Admiral corrected.
You mean technically, the Commander replied. The other 18 will do whatever you say because they need our protection.
What's the status of the attack? The Admiral asked, ignoring the Commander's comments.
6 of 8 strike platforms have confirmed launches as instructed. That's 60 Super J KKVs on the way to their targets.
Do we have recon assets standing by to assess the results? The Admiral inquired.
Yes, sir. All known battle platforms are being tracked by stealth jump recon drones, and manned scout ships are standing by to perform additional recon once the drones confirm the strikes. The Commander assured his superior.
In addition, I have destroyers and more than 100 gunships ready to attack any battle platforms that might somehow escape destruction.
I assume all our defenses are on full alert? The Admiral wondered.
If there was an alert level higher than Condition 1, we'd be at it now, Admiral.
The Commander looked at the Admiral. You don't really think there are Jung ships out there waiting to attack us, do you?
No, I don't, the Admiral admitted. But only a fool believes that he couldn't be wrong.
Chapter 9. Kayla Yosef was unemployed for the first time in her life, having resigned from her dream job nearly a week ago. For days after resigning, she had been unsure of her decision, but recent events had convinced her otherwise. Like many, she had never fully trusted Admiral Gagliardi, and had found solace in the knowledge that there were people like Dayton Scott to keep him in check. Now, with the President and his family dead, and Gagliardi having seized command of all the industrialized Alliance worlds, especially Earth, war appeared inevitable. If she had to go to war again, she wanted to be sure she was following leaders she believed in, leaders she could trust. During her entire career in the service, only one person had truly inspired her and made her believe in what she was doing. When he died, she had lost her way for several years. She'd become an automaton of sorts, going to work each day simply to fulfill her obligations to her employers and collect enough compensation to pay her bills. It was an endless cycle she had expected to continue until the day she too passed, and it had depressed her to no end. The job at the Institute had breathed new hope and purpose into her life. Finally, she was able to do cutting-edge work, science that might actually help society, instead of adding to the military's arsenal of weapons that were meant to protect it and keep it from destroying itself. But would it have been enough, given the current events? She doubted it. Most likely, she would have been recalled by Fleet to work on another top-secret project touted to crush their enemies. She would have found herself back in the same grind. Her comm unit buzzed, derailing her contemplations. She picked it up and checked the display screen, recognizing the caller.
"It's about time," she said, answering the call.
"Sorry," Captain Hunt replied. "Everyone's at full alert. We were boarded upon arrival in the system and then escorted to orbit. We just started loading an hour ago."
"Where are you?"
"In Earth orbit, Transfer Station 4. Are you ready to go?"
"Me and about 40 others," Kayla replied.
40? How did you find 40 people willing to chuck it all and leave Earth?"
"All I had to do was tell them who they'd be fighting for," Kayla said. "It worked on me, remember?"
Captain Hunt chuckled. "It worked on all of us, Kayla."
"How are we going to get that many people up to your ship without raising suspicion?" Kayla asked, "especially with everyone on alert."
"I've got that all worked out," Captain Hunt assured her. "Just get everyone to Aronson's warehouse in the Branberry District as quickly as possible. Go in by yourself and ask for Everett Bertel. He knows what to do."
"Ooh," Kayla cooed. "It sounds very cloak and dagger."
"Listen, Kayla," Captain Hunt said, his voice becoming serious. "Something has come up. Something I need your help with."
"What is it?"
"A piece of cargo will be arriving at Aronson's. A very special piece of cargo. About the size of a small car. It requires very special handling and has very specific power requirements. It even has its own mini-fusion reactor."
"What is it?" Kayla wondered.
"To be honest, they wouldn't tell me. All I was told is that it is of the utmost importance that this cargo makes it to the Karazari."
"And you're willing to take it on board?"
"I wasn't at first," he admitted. "But they assured me that if I knew what the cargo was, I'd be willing to accept it."
"Are you sure you can believe them?" Kayla wondered. "I mean, considering everything that's happened the last few days?"
which is why I need you to check it out. If you think you should come on board, I'm good with it.
I understand, Kayla replied.
I'll take care of it, Chris.
Thanks, Kayla. See you soon.
Kayla ended the call and immediately placed one herself.
Hello?
A man answered, his voice unsure.
It's me. It's time.
Thank God, the man replied, relieved.
Aronson's warehouse in the Branberry District. 2 hours. Call everyone,
she instructed as she used her comm unit to search a map of the district in question.
There's a bar about 2 blocks west of the warehouse. Have everyone assemble there until I call.
40 people walking into a bar? No, that's not going to look suspicious.
Pretend you're a softball team after a game or something. It's the weekend after all.
This is Australia, Kayla.
A rugby team, then.
There's 40 of us, he reminded her.
2 teams, then, Kayla exclaimed. Use your imagination.
What are you going to be doing?
I'll be getting things set up. I'll call you with further instructions.
Got it, the man replied.
Be careful.
You too, she said, hanging up.
Kayla immediately rose from her seat, grabbing the bag she had kept packed and ready to go since she had arrived a week ago. On her way to the door, she grabbed her purse, but stopped dead in her tracks when someone knocked.
Kayla stood frozen, unsure what to do. The knock repeated.
She quietly set her bags on the floor and pulled a stunner from one of them. She pressed the arming button on the side of the stunner and stepped carefully toward the door, holding the device at the ready. Once at the door, she peeked through the peephole, but it was blocked.
Shit, she thought.
A moment later, she spoke.
Who is it?
Room service.
It was a man's voice with an Australian accent.
I didn't order anything, she replied. I have an order of strawberry shortcake for room 314, the man explained, for a K. Yosef.
The explanation caught her by surprise. Strawberry shortcake was one of her favorite desserts, but she hadn't had one for as long as she could remember.
Why can't I see you? She demanded.
I don't know, ma'am. Perhaps your peephole is broken.
Leave it beside the door, she insisted.
As you wish, ma'am, the man promised. Good day.
Kayla waited for the man to leave. After a few minutes, she decided that she had no choice. She had to open the door. It would take her nearly an hour to get to the Branberry District and get everything ready with this Everett Bertle person. Kayla took a deep breath, then slowly and quietly opened the door, her stunner held ready. Once open, she peered outside, looking for the dessert the man had promised. She spotted a silver service tray on the floor with a dome that was likely covering the food. But before she could reach down to pull the tray inside, someone grabbed her hand, stripping away her stunner, and pushed her inside, immediately covering her mouth with his hand, preventing her from screaming. Kayla found herself pinned against the wall of her hotel room, a muscular young man holding her captive, standing only centimeters from her face. She looked into his eyes and noticed something familiar.
"Kayla, it's me, Crispin."
Kayla suddenly recognized the man. It had been many years, and he was at least 12 to 15 years older than what she remembered, but his eyes were the same. Crispin slowly removed his hand from her mouth.
"Please don't scream. I won't hurt you."
"Crispin? Little Crispin Bornett?"
"That's me," he replied, easing his grip on her slightly, but not letting go entirely. "Not so little anymore, though."
"Oh, my God, what are you?"
The realization suddenly hit her. The news. The president. That was why his name sounded so familiar when she heard the reports. It was him. It was the same Crispin Bornett.
"I didn't do it,"
Crispin assured her, noticing the change in her expression. Kayla didn't say anything.
"I was there, yes, and I was tasked with killing him, but I didn't, I swear it. We were set up."
Crispin looked at her for a moment. "You believe me, don't you?"
"Why should I?" Kayla asked. "Believe the little boy you used to babysit,"
Crispin suggested in an almost pleading voice. Crispin stepped back, releasing her.
"If you don't, I don't know who else will,"
he added, offering her back her stunner. Kayla took the stunner from him, checking that it was still operative.
"How the hell did you find me?"
"I'm Spec Ops," Crispin replied. "I've got skills, and you've been using the same comm unit number for the last 20 years.
Crispin held up his own comm unit, her number on the display screen.
"It was my mother's," he explained. "I've been carrying it since she died."
"I'm sorry to hear about that, Crispin."
"Past history," Crispin assured her, "but thanks."
"You said you were tasked with killing President Scott?"
"Yes."
"By who?"
"I don't know that I should say,"
he replied. No one could put you in danger.
Oh, I'm already in danger.
Not like this.
Trust me, I am.
Crispin looked confused.
What is it you want from me?
I need help. I need to get off this world.
You're wanted for killing the President of the Earth, the leader of the Alliance, Crispin. Where the hell do you think you're going to be able to hide?
I thought maybe one of the smaller worlds, the ones no one really cares about. Kayla thought for a moment.
Who tasked you?
She asked, realizing the implication in his choice of verbs. When he didn't answer, she pressed.
If it's who I think it is, I may be able to help you.
Crispin was hesitant.
You came to me, Crispin. If you want my help, you're going to have to tell me the truth.
Gagliardi, he finally admitted.
Oh, my God,
she exclaimed, her hand covering her mouth. Who did you think it was? He asked, surprised by her reaction.
That is who I thought,
she replied. Then why did you react that way?
I don't know,
she admitted. It's still a shock, I guess. Are you sure about this? Are you sure it was Gagliardi? I was told the order came from him by my handler, and for it to work as well as it did, there had to be someone at the top pulling strings. I mean, his weapon shield was down and everything.
I thought he was killed by an explosion, Kayla said.
He was, Crispin explained. Just before I was going to take the shot, the entire stage blew up. It's a long story, Kayla.
One that you're going to tell me on the way,
Kayla assured him as she picked up her bags. Where are we going?
This is your lucky day, kid,
Kayla told him as she grabbed his hand and led him to the door. I'm taking you further away from this world than you could possibly hope for.
But we have to do something,
Crispin insisted. We have to tell someone. We can't just let Gagliardi get away with this. I mean, he's taken over the entire Alliance, Kayla.
I know, and that's what we're going to do. We're going to tell someone what's really going on here. But we have to tell the right person, and that person isn't on this planet. Now move your ass, Crispy.
The key to winning in any type of combat is to always be thinking 10 to 20 seconds ahead, General Tellus explained as he watched Nathan and Vladimir sparring in the Aurora's gym. Like trying to anticipate your opponent's next move, Nathan surmised as he blocked Vladimir's punch. It is much more than that, the general replied, smiling. No one can guess an opponent's next move repeatedly with any degree of accuracy. Even those who are lucky will eventually find that their luck runs out. What I am talking about is analyzing what the most probable moves are, deciding how best to deal with each of them, and doing this before they take place. The general moved toward the two men. If you please, Captain. Nathan stepped aside, making room for General Tellus to take his place against Vladimir. He's all yours, General. What are the most likely forms of attack that Lieutenant Commander Kamenetsky will use next? The general asked. He likes to jab with his left 3 to 4 times and then follow with a right cross or a right uppercut, Nathan replied. The jabs are of little consequence as he is simply trying to distract you with them so he can sneak his right hand in. But you should already have decided how you will respond to his right-handed attacks. If he attacks with a cross, I would use the opposite hand in a sweeping motion to add to his momentum, which will carry his arm across and cause him to over-rotate. This will leave his side unprotected, and my left arm will be free to strike.
So you'll punch him in the ribs with your left, Nathan surmised. Actually, I would stiffen my fingers and cause the fingertips of my combat gloves to form edges, allowing me to penetrate between his ribs and into his lungs.
Ouch, Nathan exclaimed. Remind me to never box with you, Vladimir added.
And if he threw an uppercut? Nathan asked. I would lean back and allow him to miss, and then perform the same penetration move but from further aside, as it would be easier for him to get his arm back down to block if I came in at the same 45-degree angle as with his cross, the general explained. But allow me to further elaborate. Let us assume that he has a cohort a few paces behind him who is raising his weapon to fire in my direction. In such a case, when I performed the penetration, I would curl my fingers and grab hold of his ribs, twist him around, and step behind him, using him as a shield. When he takes the friendly fire intended for me, my right hand is free to draw my sidearm and fire at the other man.
And if the second man charged for a hand-to-hand attack? Nathan asked. After the penetration, I would use my right hand to push my victim into the second man, while I step to the left out of the second man's path. When he tumbles into the body of the first man, I can pull my sidearm and shoot him as I advance past him. It is about looking at the entire environment, every combatant, every non-combatant, every object, the air pressure, gravity levels, humidity, winds, amount of static electricity in the air, the level of training my combatants are demonstrating, the reaction of non-combatants when witnessing the horrors of deadly combat. All of these things influence every possible action and outcome of any given situation.
But how can you possibly analyze all of these elements at once? Vladimir wondered.
It does take considerable training, the general admitted. Although all Gottesjak are trained to think in this manner, some are more adept at this than others. That is why there are leaders and there are followers.
How did you become so adept at it? Nathan wondered.
I realized early on that it required a greater understanding of all things, not just combat tactics. Human psychology, economics, cultures, societies, weather patterns, physics. These and many more must be thoroughly understood in order to excel at what we call predictive combat strategies and tactics.
In a way, I believe I already do this, Nathan said. In the past, it was more on a subconscious level. I didn't realize I was doing it. But ever since my rebirth, I have been seeing things more clearly.
Can you elaborate? General Tellus asked, as if trying to force Nathan to think deeper.
Nathan crossed his arms, taking in a deep breath, as he looked at the gym floor, thinking.
Well, it's like I'm seeing everything in slow motion. The more intense, the more complex, the more dangerous the situation is, the slower it seems to go. Or, should I say, the faster my brain is at processing and making decisions. For example, when defending Raccoon the other day, the moment we received the distress call, I started analyzing all the possible attack strategies. I analyzed the situation from the Dusans' point of view. I decided they would do one of two things. If their egos drove their decision-making, then they would want to punish the people of Raccoon. That would mean shock and awe and targeting infrastructure. If they were being smart and trying to minimize the Gunyoki threat, then they would target the Rani plant first and the race platform second.
Why not the race platform first? Vladimir wondered. That's where the majority of the fighters are located, and that's where the initial defensive response would come from.
Only a handful of Gunyoki fighters can jump, and those pilots barely have any training in jump fighter combat tactics, Nathan explained. They are not yet a threat to any Dusan forces attacking the Rogan system. The threat is when many of them are equipped with jump drives. That means you hit the Rani plant first and take out their ability to create mini jump drives, neutralize the threat before it is created.
So when you jumped to Raccoon, you already knew what you were going to do, Vladimir surmised.
Not quite, Nathan admitted.
He knew what he was going to do in either situation, General Tellus corrected.
I did, Nathan agreed. However, I expected the attack to be on the Rani plant. And here's the scary part. It was all in the math.
In the math? Vladimir wondered.
You calculated the probabilities, didn't you? The general realized, smiling.
Not exactly, Nathan corrected. First, I analyzed the probable gains and losses of each. Second, I calculated the odds based on the Dusan's past behavior to date, specifically whether their leader would make an ego-driven decision versus a logic-driven one. I determined that given a limited number of ships, resources, and the area that he needed to hold on to in order to grow his forces, he could not afford to make ego-driven decisions, at least not in this instance.
You did all this in mere seconds? Vladimir asked in disbelief.
To be honest, it felt like a lot longer than a few seconds, Nathan admitted.
But yeah, I suppose so. He looked at General Tellus.
Is that the type of thinking you're talking about?
Yes, the general agreed. But you're taking it a step further. You're looking at the big picture, the long-term effects of each potential move by your enemy, weighing the risks against the rewards, and then predicting which course of action your enemy would take based on past history.
But I had a plan in my head for both possibilities, Nathan pointed out.
Which means you are prepared for either outcome, the general replied. That is the essence of predictive combat strategies and tactics. Knowing what your enemy will do and how they will react to what you do. That is what wins battles and that is what wins wars. Not jump drives, plasma torpedoes, or jump KKVs.
Vladimir looked at Nathan.
Did you do this before you surrendered to the Zhang? Did you analyze all possible actions and outcomes and decide that surrendering was the best course of action?
I'm not sure, Nathan admitted. I do remember that at the time I felt it was the course of action that offered the Earth the best chance of surviving over the long run. But I don't remember analyzing any other options.
I did, General Tellis told him. After your surrender, I ran every possible scenario. Your surrender was the only option that gave the Earth a chance of survival.
And jumping into a Jung ocean, scanning his brain and cloning him? Vladimir asked. Did you analyze that plan as well?
I did, General Tellis admitted. I concluded that it was too risky and the potential of it leading to future conflicts was too high to risk.
Then why did you do it? Nathan wondered.
It was my job to protect you, Captain. I failed at that job. In case you have not noticed, my inability to accept failure is my one true fault.
You're gonna have to do better than that, Nathan insisted.
Sometimes actions, no matter the risk, are necessary in order to achieve greater things, General Tellis stated.
Katone risk goyet, Vladimir began, waxing philosophic.
Drinks not champagne, Nathan finished.
Vladimir looked surprised.
You're speaking Russian now?
I've picked a little up lately, Nathan admitted.
I have not, General Tellis reminded them.
Who takes no risk, drinks not champagne, Vladimir stated, an old Russian proverb.
Actually, most cultures have similar proverbs, Nathan pointed out.
What is English version? No pain, no gain?
Vladimir joked, rolling his eyes. Nathan ignored his friend's jest, turning to the general.
Speaking of risk, I've been thinking about the plan to steal the Tayenta. I've also been thinking about how we're going to rescue the Koronari.
The two are not related, the general reminded him.
Actually, I think they are, Nathan argued. What both plans are lacking are diversions. They're both frontal attacks against established defenses, and in both cases we're outnumbered by at least 4-1, and that number goes up exponentially with each minute of battle that passes. Those are risks, very serious risks. However, we need that battleship, and we need those men. More importantly, we owe those men and Captain Navarro our support. Our willingness to take that risk, especially to rescue our own, is what makes people willing to fight for us, because they know that we will fight for them. So this is a case where, although the risks far outweigh the rewards, the risk must still be taken.
We are in complete agreement, Captain, General Tellis assured him. You spoke of the need for diversions for both plans.
If we create a diversion for the attack on the Tayenta, then that same tactic might not work as well when we try to use it to rescue the Koronari. The same is true in reverse.
Unless we allow time to pass between the two events, the general suggested.
The problem with that is neither mission can wait. We need to steal the Tayenta before she goes into service, and we have to rescue the Koronari while they are still being held in the same place. So why not do them at the same time?
We don't have the resources, Vladimir reminded him. We only have one real warship, remember?
When we fight, we strike, jump out of range, come about, and jump back into attack again, right? Nathan explained.
Instead of jumping out a few light seconds or a few light minutes, why not jump out a few light years? More precisely, 4.41 light years.
You want to fight two battles in two entirely different systems at the same time? Vladimir asked.
He looked at Tellis. Is that even possible?
Actually, it is, General Tellis admitted. It is also an interesting idea.
Each battle would act as a diversion for the other. If we time it right, we'll be pulling Dusan ships back and forth between systems a few times before they realize we're playing them. Each time we do, we'll have nearly a full minute during which the defenses we'll have to deal with will be minimal.
It is a bold plan, the general agreed. If the Dusan take 3 or 4 cycles to figure it out, that could give us the time we need to accomplish both goals. However, if they do not fall for it, you will be fighting 2 battles in which you will be severely outnumbered.
I figure it's all in how we sell it, Nathan insisted. Every time we jump, we have to convince the Dusan that that is where the battle is really taking place.
Vladimir looked at them both. You two do realize how crazy this sounds, don't you?
Katon yet riskoyet, Nathan said, a wry smile on his face.
Please, Vladimir protested.
You don't even say it right.
Kayla and Crispin entered the rundown front office of the Aronson warehouse, both of them wearing caps and sunglasses she had picked up in a nearby convenience store.
Where is everyone? Crispin wondered.
It's Sunday, she replied, keeping her voice low. I'm pretty sure they're normally closed.
After a minute, a burly middle-aged man came into the office. He paused a moment, taking in the pair in caps and sunglasses, smiling.
Nice hats. the man finally commented as he continued into the office.
Hunt send you?
Yes, Kayla replied, taking off her sunglasses. Are you Bertel?
The one and only, the man grumbled. I was told to meet with a woman. Hunt said nothing about a man.
You think a lady's going to walk into a place like this unescorted? Crispin said.
Your eyes sensitive to light or something?
Bertel asked, challenging Crispin. Crispin smiled.
How'd you guess?
Bertel rolled his eyes and then headed back into the warehouse.
Follow me.
Kayla and Crispin went around the counter and followed Bertel through the door into the warehouse. They walked through rows of unevenly stacked cargo containers, making their way to the back of the building. Near the roll-up loading doors were a row of 30 containers, each of them about 2 meters in length and a meter in both width and height.
These are yours, Bertel instructed. Put whatever you want in them.
The seals have been removed, Crispin noted.
Yeah, smart guy. How the hell else would you put your people in them?
Then you already know what we're smuggling? Kayla realized, sounding uneasy.
Yeah, and I don't much care either, Bertel replied. All I know is I get to keep 30 of the 60 fusion reactors that were in those containers. That's gonna bring me a tidy profit on the black market. Why your people want to stow away aboard a cargo ship going nowhere is none of my business, lady. So how about you get your people into these containers so I can seal them up, ship them out, and go home and enjoy what's left of my only day off?
You can replace the seal so they will pass inspection? Kayla asked.
Why do you think your friend hired me?
Bertel replied, sounding annoyed. What about the inspection scanners? Crispin asked.
Fusion reactors are always on, Bertel explained. Even in an idle state, they'll screw up the sensors. Dial the remaining up a few percent, and the port inspectors will assume there are too many reactors at idle, just like the manifest says. Trust me, those guys ain't gonna blink twice at these things. Now, can we get this over with, or what?
What about the other cargo? Kayla asked. The one that was just added.
Over there, Bertel replied, pointing to the container at the end of the row. I'll be in the office. Call me when you're ready to seal everything up and ship them out.
Kayla and Crispin headed for the far end of the row, while Bertel headed back to the front office. The container was larger than the others, similar in length but taller and wider by a full meter. What the hell is in here? Crispin wondered as he examined the manifest on the side of the container. It says fusion reactors, just like the others, but 6 instead of 2. I don't know, Kayla replied as she began unlocking the container.
Are you sure we should open it?
Crispin wondered. I was told to inspect the contents, to make sure it isn't something that would endanger the ship, Kayla explained. She unlocked the doors and swung them open. The container was large enough to walk inside, although they both had to bend over slightly. This is double-walled, Kayla realized, probably to help scatter the inspection scanners.
Won't that raise suspicion? Crispin wondered.
Not if Bertel can replace the seals, like he said. Lots of things get shipped in scanner-proof containers, so the contents don't get damaged by the scanners themselves. The seals will indicate that the contents were visually inspected, if he does them correctly. Crispin followed Kayla inside the container, stooping over to fit inside the low ceiling. There are 2 containers in here, Kayla realized. This one is a fusion reactor, she said, scanning it with her data pad. It's running at nearly 25%.
Is that to make it look like 6 reactors?
Crispin wondered. But why? This container is scanner-shielded.
Crispin moved around the opposite side of the first container, wiggling into the tight confines.
There's a power cable coming from this container to the next, he realized.
It must be powering whatever is inside this one, Kayla decided. Help me remove this access panel.
Crispin wiggled back out and came around to Kayla's side, moving deeper into the main container as she unlatched the access plate. The two of them carefully removed the access plate, and Crispin slid it toward the entrance, just enough for her to see inside.
"Oh, my God!" she exclaimed, looking into the second container.
Crispin moved deeper into the container to stand next to her, inspecting the contents for himself.
"Shit!" "This mission has 2 targets," General Tellis told the group of command officers and unit leaders assembled in a large briefing room on board the Aurora. "The rescue of the Coronari and the capture of the Takarn battleship Tayenta."
"Holy shit!" Josh said under his breath.
"You aren't kidding,"
Loki replied in a similar tone. General Tellis paused for a moment, waiting for the initial information to sink in, and for the images to appear on the wall behind him.
"The Darvino and Takar systems are 4.4 light-years apart," he began.
There are two battleships in the Takar system, one in an orbit over Takara, paralleling that of the orbital shipyard where the Tayenta is being assembled, the other maintaining position further out among the outer re-engineered worlds of Takar. In addition, they have two heavy cruisers and two missile frigates stationed in the system. There are also an ever-changing number of gunships, octofighters, and various assault shuttles and utility ships in the system, along with dozens of cargo and passenger ships coming and going on a regular basis. In short, your tactical displays will be full of contacts, many of which are not warships, but should still be suspect at all times. In the Darvino system, the Dusan maintain a single battleship, one heavy cruiser, two frigates, and a handful of gunships and octofighters. Also, their two remaining troop ships are stationed in orbit over Coronair, since the majority of their troops, including most of the Zen Anor, are stationed there, using the abandoned Coronari bases as their own. The Darvino system also has significant non-military traffic. That leaves one battleship, three heavy cruisers, and two frigates unaccounted for. Our recon drones have had intermittent contact with a few of these ships at various points all over the Pantorus cluster. So it is reasonable to assume that some or all of these ships are patrolling the cluster in order to enforce the Dusan's control over the region. It is these ships that cause us the most concern. We must assume that the Dusan maintain contact with these patrol ships and can order them to any point within the cluster at a moment's notice. We must also assume these ships are able to jump the breadth of the cluster at will and multiple times before requiring time to recharge. General Tellus paused, taking a breath. Our primary strategy is to attack Dusan assets in multiple locations in order to force them to guess as to our true objectives.
Pardon me, sir, Commander Verbeek, the commander of the Aurora's air group, said. Given the known values of every possible target, wouldn't it be reasonable to assume that the Dusan would simply prioritize their assets and assign ships to protect them according to that value?
Logically, yes, General Tellus agreed. We're hoping that they will first attempt to defend all assets and not begin prioritizing them until well into the attack.
Why would they do that? The commander asked.
Because the Dusan are still Jung at heart, Nathan said, adding his voice to the discussion. They need to show those they have conquered that they are in complete control. They need to demonstrate that they cannot be challenged successfully.
More importantly, General Tellus added, the Dusan are stretched thin and they cannot afford to lose any of the assets that we will be attacking. The loss of any one of them negatively affects the one thing they hope to achieve above all else, to grow their fleet.
Then why don't we just throw a bunch of jump missiles at their shipyards? Commander Verbeek suggested.
These shipyards are protected by a multi-layered defense system. First, they have jump scrambling fields which prevent jump weapons from arriving any closer than 50 kilometers. This affords their second layer, their point defense turrets, ample time to deal with the incoming missiles. Lastly, they use electronic countermeasure fields that interfere with our missiles' ability to lock onto targets and make last-minute course corrections. This also means that our missiles cannot take evasive action to avoid point defense fire and then steer onto the target after breaching the point defense perimeter. In essence, it reduces them to simple projectiles with warheads. As you know, we have a limited supply of jump missiles, which is why we have adopted a policy of recovering those used in battle that fail to find their targets. We need those jump missiles to engage Dusan warships. We cannot afford to waste them on such a well-protected target, regardless of that target's value. Even after its destruction, there will still be many more targets to deal with in the future.
Understood, Commander Verbeek said.
The strike group will be divided into subgroups. The command group will be located within the Pantorus cluster and will be using the Glendanon as its operational platform. Despite the fact that she has been fitted with plasma turrets and point defenses in recent weeks, her primary method of survival will be to jump away from any attackers. The command group will be under the command of Captain Taylor, who will be coordinating all attacks and communications using jump comm drones and comm buoys.
Cameron stood to address the room.
We will be deploying multiple jump-equipped comm buoys in every engagement area. Every time a combat element jumps into a new engagement area, they are to check the comm buoys in that area for updated instructions from combat command, as well as battle status updates. The buoys themselves will jump about the system in order to avoid attack, but will always be in a position that allows data exchange within a minute or two of entry into the area. If you must depart the area prior to completing your data exchange, your escape jump should be directly to the last known location of combat command. If the Glendanon is not there when you arrive, a comm buoy will be there for two full algorithm cycles, after which it will jump back to the post-battle rally point.
Thank you, Captain, General Tellus said as Cameron took her seat. The second group will be the Aurora, whose primary responsibility will be to attack Dusan warships in every system in the cluster. Captain Scott will be following an attack schedule, which will be updated as needed by Combat Command. Within that schedule, the Aurora will conduct harassment and diversion strikes as her captain sees fit. However, the Aurora will be at her scheduled location to support each mission-critical event.
This is insane, Vladimir whispered to Jessica.
Yeah, pretty cool, huh?
Vladimir just looked at her in dismay.
The third subgroup will be the rescue group. This group will be composed of raptors, cargo shuttles, and boxcars, commanded by Mr. Sheehan aboard the Saik.